Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Welcome to Upfront with Darren Bent and me, Sam Matterface. This is the show that takes you into the world of the number nine as we find out what it takes to be a top-flight striker.
Into the Peltier, right-footed, side-footed towards the far post, comes back to Darren Bent, and Darren Bent scores on his debut!
We'll discuss their career-defining goals, the pressure of staying at the very top of the game, and the feeling of when the ball hits the back of the net.
Lovely ball. Oh, Bent! His 100th goal!
You're listening to Upfront with Darren Bent and me, Sam Matterface, on TalkSport.
216 goals, 10 clubs, 568 games. League Cup winner, Premier League 100 club member, 4 goals in 13 appearances for England, more goals in the Premier League than Didier Drogba, a club hero at Ipswich and Charlton, and famous for wonderful clothing, sparkling personality, and failing at celebrity mastermind. It's Darren Bent. How are you?
Yeah, I was all right until you added that last bit in.
At least I got it right. I heard Bobby Zamora talk about you recently, and he said, boy, that man could finish. Is that what you were? You were a finisher?
Yeah, I would say that. I'd like to think. I mean, listen, I'm missing my fair share of chances, like a lot of people did. But I always knew that even if I did miss a chance, if I get the next one, I'd always pull it away. And it was something, and my coaches would probably attest to this, that I worked on really, really hard day in, day out. Like, you go back to my Ipswich Town days, I'd be out there on the training pitch before training started. I'd obviously train. Then at lunchtime, I'd quickly go and have my dinner, go back outside and do some more in the afternoon. And then, obviously, when I was a lot younger, say I was about 17 years old in the youth team, I'd then go home back to the digs, then shut the training ground. And me and another guy, Darren Ambrose, would go back to the training ground. We'd kick a ball over the fence, leave the ball in the bush, come back obviously in the evening, jump the fence, get that ball back out the bush and carry on shooting in the evening. So it's something that we worked on for years, years and years.
You two came through at a similar sort of time. You're both really young players at Ipswich Town. Everyone talked about the two Darrens. Were you mates from a very early age?
Well, he was at Ipswich Town from, I think, 10 years old. So he was there a lot longer than I was. And I came quite late. I was 14 years old. But I think when I first got there, we was kind of obviously about unsure about each other. But then on the pitch, we just clicked. I'd make the runs. He'd find me with scintillating passes and I'd put them away. So even though at first we maybe weren't as close friends, we ended up living together and becoming best of friends because we had the drive off the pitch about who was going to get into the first team first, who was going to be more successful in their career. And it just went on and on and on from that. But I always say to people that, and to be fair, I don't probably give him enough credit that he deserves, because I don't think I'd have been the player or certainly gotten the platform that I did if it weren't for Daz, because he was one of the only midfield players I played with that if I made a run, he'd find me. And his range of passing was absolutely brilliant. Like, it went unnoticed, and that's why he went to Newcastle so young. He went at 17 years old, which is scary.
Were you always a number nine? Were you a number nine at God Manchester Rovers, for example?
Yeah, I was, yeah. I mean, at God Manchester, I wore number eight, and I remember going there, and I have conversations with the coach, and he always says to me, remember your first year and a half? Because I remember my first 6 games I played, I scored 20 goals, and he was like, wow. And then the following season, I scored 99. Which is obviously scary.
Not bad.
You know what I mean? I mean, I'm devastated I didn't get the 100. And I mean, my last game, I think I scored seven in a cup final. So I don't know how I didn't get to the magic 100. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I've always played centre forward. But when I got to Ipswich Town, I play up front a little bit, but we used to play like a 4-3-3, and I was either left or right, and occasionally I'd play centre forward. Like, it was Marcus Bent down the middle, Ambrose on the left, me on the right, and it just about getting them behind. So I played wide a lot, but as I got older and then Joe Royal took over, I then started playing more and more centre forward, and that's when we used to play a two. So it was me and Shefty Coochie, but it was a typical big man little man where he'd go up to him. I mean, he was unbelievable in the air. He'd head it down and it was about me finishing it. So that was probably the last time for a sustained period where I got to play in a conventional two up front.
Who taught you to be a number nine?
It's a difficult one because obviously being at Ipswich Town, I mean, before I got to Ipswich, I was an Ian Wright fan, Arsenal fan, so I'd watch Ian Wright all the time, and you play for Go Manchester and your Sunday league club and your Saturday league sides, so I all played centre forward. But then when I got to Ipswich Town, I was privileged enough to watch like David Johnson first and foremost, but then Marcus Stewart.
It's Clapham's cross, it's Stewart, it's 3-1 Ipswich!
And I was really close with Marcus Stewart. I mean, he was a really big, big influence on me coming through the youth system, and even Matty Holland. I know
he's got a lot of goals for Ipswich.
He's got a lot of goals, and even Matty Holland as well. I know he didn't play centre forward, but it was like him and Marcus Stewart kind of took me under their wing. But Stewie was always helping with me. I remember him coming to me one training session and saying, "Listen, I've looked at your game and you're finishing, and one aspect you need to work on is your volleying. Like, you're not a very good volleyer." And at first, I took it to heart and thought, "Well, cheers, I'm just started." But I understand now why he was saying these things to me, because he saw the potential and saw how far I could go. And you know what I mean? If I ever saw him now, I'd say to Marcus Stewart, "Oh, thanks for everything you've done for me. You really played a big part in me getting to where I could get to." Because, as I said, always giving me little tips, doing finishing sessions for me. And he was absolutely brilliant. As you said, scored a lot of goals himself.
And did you listen to that, and although you took it to heart, actually start working on your volleying technique as a result of that conversation?
I think I went straight back out there and started working on it, because I was so eager to show him that, well, I can volley the ball. And to be fair, when I think about it now, I wasn't a good volleyer of the ball. Like, I'd hit it and it'd go anywhere, but it's just that determination and that drive and to better myself and show everybody that, well, I am a good volleyer. I am a very, very good finisher. And I think to myself, what I like about Marcus Stewart in that situation is that he was Ipswich's main man, but I was coming. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was a youngster, but the reputation was growing. I was getting training more and more with the first team. I'd won the Golden Boot in the Reserve League. So he knew I was coming. But for him to still take his time out and still try and help me and make me progress, that shows, I mean, a lot about him, because there was a lot of players there who were centre forwards who didn't really want to help me. They kind of just turned a blind eye to me, whereas he wanted to work with me because he obviously saw the potential.
In my mind's eye, I can see you darting in behind the defence, checking back, pulling off a defender, making space to create that opportunity. How important did you feel movement and timing was as a striker, and especially in your game?
Well, it was everything. I mean, I'd probably have to say the biggest influence when it came to playing centre forward and movement was my dad. He played when he was a kid, but he always used to say to me, even from the day I started football to the day I retired, he'd still get on my case about movement, because he always used to say to me, "Daz, it does not matter who you're playing against, they could be the best defenders in the world. If your movement is good, they can't stop it." And it was the right call, because if I stand still, the best defenders in the world at the time, John Terry's, Rio Ferdinand's, these guys, it's easy for them. They can mark me, they can always see me. But he always said, you need to keep moving them. Just keep moving them around. And eventually, if your movement's good and you keep getting in there, the chances will come. And that's how it kind of progressed, really. Like, my movement was okay at Ipswich. I was more just running in behind at Ipswich Town, because it was a bit more conventional then. The kick over the top, you get in behind, score goals. But when obviously the higher up the chain you go, Premier League, defenders are cleverer, they're quicker, and that's when my movement had to be so precise, where if I want to run to the near post, I had to run to the back post first, just to put them off balance, and then dart to the near. It can never really be just one movement. Like, if I wanted to get to the near post, I had to go back stick first, just to put them on their heels, and then dart to the near post. So it was always one run for them, and one run for myself.
Oh, we've had an absolute travesty here. VAR, no handball. How is that not a penalty?
I don't know. I don't understand the decision.
How would VAR have changed your game, do you think?
Probably chalks off about 60% of my goals. the offside flag would have been...
Why do you think that is?
The offside flag, because the way I played the game, I was always... It was like a risk taker. Like, I'm always chancing it. Like, I might be offside six times in a game, but I know there might be two times when I'm not offside, and they're the two that I remember, and I put them in the back of the net.
Let's warm you up with a couple of quick fire questions, just to get a sense of who Darren Bent really is. What is your favourite goal that you scored?
The favourite goal I ever scored was probably against Wolves for Derby County, right towards the end, actually. It was a volley
over the top for Bent. Oh, what a goal! A thing of beauty from Derby County.
Why I like this goal so much is not the execution where I absolutely smash it and it flies into the roof of the net. it was because I'd had the same kind of a similar but not easier volley about 10 minutes before that, and I completely blasted it over the bar. Like it came in at the back stick, and all I had to do was really hit the target, and I probably would have scored. But I completely smashed it over the bar. So when that one came over, a lot of other players might have gone, you know what, I missed the first one, so let me just get it down under control and maybe get a shot off. But I didn't even think that. As it dropped over my shoulder, I thought, I'm just going to smash it again, and my technique was right on this occasion, and it flew into the top corner.
What was the most important goal you scored?
You've really got me there with the most important one. Do you know what, for my own personal
career... It's not Celebrity Mastermind, don't worry.
Nah, do you know what, for my own personal career, it was scoring my first goal for England, because for so long I'd had caps and caps and caps and hadn't managed to get a goal, and it was kind of weighing on my shoulders, because as a centre forward, for me, you're judged on goals. And when you play for your country, you've got to be able to show that you can score goals at that level. So I think the first one of that was massive for me, especially in terms of international football, because I went on a little run after that. I think I scored in the next three or four internationals after that, so it kind of stood me in good stead for the next international. So I think that first international goal was the most important.
Yeah, 7th of September 2010. And we'll get to that in more detail, I think, a little bit later on. And what's the weirdest goal you've scored? You know what's in my mind here, don't you?
Darren Bent has now scored in his last five games, and that is a perfect start for Sunderland.
Just look at the replay. By all accounts, it looks as if the ball deflected, not off a shin, not off a boot, but off a balloon.
Yeah, it's a weird situation, isn't it? Because take us back, you're playing for Sunderland. You're on the left edge of the area. You hit it towards the goal. It takes a deflection off of a random beach ball, which has been thrown in by a member of the crowd. And it wrong-foots Pepe Reina and goes in the other corner. First of all, I mean, in the world of physics, how on earth does a beach ball divert an actual football? I could never get my head around that. And second of all, did you know the law at the time? Did you think to yourself, oh, they're going to chalk this off because of a beach ball interrupting the pitch?
Do you know what? When I first scored it and it went in, not one thought crossed my mind like, I think it's going to be disallowed. I've never ever thought that. I just thought to myself, I've scored a goal, brilliant, run off celebrating. Did not even cross my mind. It's only when I saw the ref's face and he was panicking a little bit, like at half time, he came up and asked me and said, oh Daz, did it hit the beach ball? And I went, yeah. And he was like, oh, I don't think it should have stood. And he was really panicking. And I think, to be fair, unfortunate, he got demoted the following weekend. But to be fair, I kind of sympathised with him because it had never ever happened before. So, do you know what I mean? It's a real difficult one, but you're right. When I think back to that goal now, like, you're right, it could have hit anything else. It could have just, Pepe Reina could have saved it. It could have got blocked. But for it to hit the ball at that precise moment, and not only that, completely divert the ball in the opposite corner to where Pepe Reina was. I mean,
it's mad.
You just can't, I couldn't think about it. And even afterwards, I still, like, that evening didn't think, oh, what a weird goal. I just thought it was a goal, like, oh, fair enough, it's another one for chalked off for the season. But it's the reaction to everybody else, like, it was absolutely everywhere.
Who was your favourite strike partner?
You know, it's a real difficult one, like, because I've gone back and forth with this. I mean, I enjoyed playing with Emil Heskey for a little bit, but we didn't really play together for that long. Kemryn Jones, I played with him for a little bit, but again, it was only, like, spurts here and there, because a lot of the time then we'd go 4-5-1, it'd be me up front on my own. So when I think back to a proper striking partner, it would have to be Shefki Kucci.
Kucci is the target and he's rolled his man, Kucci, and that is 3-0.
Me and him had an unbelievable partnership. I think one season he scored 21 and I scored 20 or something crazy like that, because we were a traditional strike partner. Like, he'd go up and win the header, I'd run in behind, or even I'd win the header and he'd go in behind. Do you know what I mean? We actually played together as a pair. We'd shot the opposition's back fours down together. We'd work hard, obviously, off the balls, little overs, try a little 1-2, try and play off each other. So I'd have to say probably Big Chef.
Who was your childhood hero? Who did you look up to when you were growing up as a striker?
Oh, Ian Wright.
Here comes Ian Wright. More celebrations for Wright and for Arsenal.
Ian Wright was my absolute hero. I mean, I grew up in Croydon, Thornton Heath. So obviously he was at Crystal Palace at the time, and when he left to go to Arsenal, that's why I became an Arsenal fan, because of him. But I tried to mimic everything that he did. His finishing, the celebrations. I mean, he was my absolute hero. Like, he could do no wrong in my eyes. He was absolutely fantastic from his movement. And I just loved his story as well, because he came onto the scene late. But to score as many goals as he did in such a short space of time, I mean, he was my absolute idol.
What manager got the best out of you as a number nine, do you think?
Again, it's another tricky one, because I mean, I'm always real thankful for George Burley. He gave me my the debut and believed that I was good enough. Obviously, Alan Kirbishley was massive on my career as well. He came and got me from the Championship, and what's quite rare is that he came and signed me from Ipswich Town at the Championship, or the old Division One as it was called back then. And he just said to me that, like, I had a conversation with him, and I remember thinking, right, is he going to buy me to you know, maybe be a good squad player, or not even a squad player, but just someone who could maybe take over from Sean Bartlett and Jonathan Johansson eventually, because he's seen something in me from the future. And he was like, well, no, I'm buying you to start from day one playing. So I always think, if he didn't give me that opportunity out the box, who knows what could have happened. But he believed in me from day one. And I remember myself, though, looking at Charlton's top scorer from the previous season, and I think it was like 6 goals. And I remember I said to myself, and I had a conversation with my dad about when we was deciding whether to go there, and I said, well, Dad, I know I can beat that. I know I've not played in the Premier League much, but I know full well I back my ability to score a lot more than 6 goals, because if my movement's good and I get the opportunities, I'll back myself to finish majority of chances. So it just seemed to fit perfectly well. And even when I moved to Charlton, I was in like, I moved into the flat, like it was like a house kind of flat, and I remember the people that owned it, they must work for Charlton Athletic, and they were big season ticket holders, and they remember saying to me, oh, we love Sean Bartlett, but he doesn't score enough goals for us, so hopefully you're going to be the man to come in. And I remember thinking about that every game that passed. I remember thinking, well, I hope I'm doing all right. And it's just weird things that you think about, but I just backed my ability to go there and score. So I'd have to probably say Alan Kerbishley, just because, as I said, he gave me that opportunity. I didn't have to wait. He put me from day one to go in and score goals.
That's really interesting, isn't it? So your landlord or landlady were massive Charlton Athletic fans, worked for the club, and they, you know, appreciated the work rate of Sean Bartlett, but they mentioned that he didn't score enough goals. So in your head, what, when you were going on the pitch, when you were playing for Charlton, you were thinking about almost impressing those guys?
Honestly, I swear, it's the strangest feeling. He said to me, I can't remember his name, I got there, turned up day one, I just signed for Charlton, and him and his wife came out to greet me, like nice big barn conversion, and they must have lived just across the road, and they just said, no, we're big Sean Bartlett fans here, hopefully you're going to come and do the business, we love him. I mean, he doesn't score enough goals, but we love Sean Bartlett, so hopefully you can come in, score a few goals, and you can do the business for us. And honestly, every time I scored a goal, for whatever reason, it might not be straight away, or I could be driving home after that game, I'd think about this couple, and then I'd see them either that evening or the next morning. They'd be like, great job you're doing there, fantastic. And I think I left after my first season, but like, I don't know why I always think about that. It was like a little bit of added pressure, even though their opinion didn't really carry much weight. I just felt like they really typified like what a Charlton Athletic fan was all about.
Bowditch for Darren Bent. Only Green to beat. It's Darren Bent still. This can seal the points. Darren Bent has sealed the points. It's Ipswich leading by 2 goals in stoppage time.
For a hanging onto a point, crossing the area. Darren Bent arises, and Darren Bent has put Charlton into the lead.
Darren Bent, what a fine header. He can do no wrong right now.
Have there been times when, as a striker, your team might have won a game? They've come away with 3 points, and everybody in the dressing room is sitting there happy. But you're sitting in the corner by your peg, and you haven't scored, or you've missed a chance, and you're still fuming. Or conversely, are there times when you've scored maybe twice in a game, but your team have drawn, or dropped a point in the last minute, or they've lost, and you're actually sitting in the corner while everybody else is moaning and whinging and digging each other out, thinking, I did all right?
Well, you know what, Sam? And this is the honest truth, right? Don't let any centre-forward tell you that if a team's won 5-0 and they haven't got one, they're not upset about it, because that is the biggest lie anyone could ever tell you. Because I've sat in dressing rooms before where we might have won 4 or 5-0, and I'm first and foremost, I'm really, really happy about the result, but I'm absolutely fuming that I've not got one. Because I'm thinking to myself, well, hold a second here. How can we score 5? Especially if you're the main man in that team and you're scoring goals regular. I'm thinking, how can we score 5 and I've not got one? So I'm honestly fuming. I'm happy for my teammates, but personally, I'm fuming. Like, I can't really smile. I can't really enjoy it. But also as well, I've had scenarios. I was at Sunderland one time, and we drew with Blackburn 2-2, and I scored 2 goals, and it was the hardest but horrible game. Weren't really a lot of quality, and I got 2 chances, and I managed to bury them both. So we go 1-0 up, I score, it goes back to 1-1. I score again, I think it's the winner, we go back to 2-2. And if anything, I'm sitting in the change room again, and I'm kind of fuming a little bit, because I think I've scored 2 goals, and Blackburn were good enough at the time to score 2. But I never forget, Nyron Nosworthy come up to me after that game, and he said, you know what, D, like, I apologise, because we know you've done everything you can at the other end of the pitch to win the game for us, and we haven't been good enough. So as much as I was fuming, when he come and said that to me, I said, well, you know what, it happens. And I kind of just like turn my back on it, it's like, okay, whatever, we just have to go again next week. So it's kind of roles reversed. But as I said, don't let any centre forward tell you that if their team scores 5, they're totally happy with it, because it's a lie.
Do you have to be quite a self-centred character, quite a sort of it's all about me type of blood. I don't want to say selfish because I think that's a... I've said that to other strikers before and I think maybe that's the wrong sort of word. I'm more sort of... When you go onto the pitch, do you have to concentrate about your role and your role only? Or do you believe that strikers have to be, especially now in the modern game, more altruistic and be team players?
Yeah, I think you have to be a little bit more versatile now. So I don't think now you have centre-forwards so much that care only about scoring goals. I just don't think that's the norm anymore. I think you look at people like Firmino, who's an absolutely fantastic striker, holds the ball up really well, brings people into play. And people, then you look at arcs of Liverpool fans, they say they wouldn't swap him in a heartbeat. They love the way he plays, even though he doesn't score that many goals. They like the way he plays and he complements the other two really, really well. So I think maybe 10, 15 years ago where we focused on centre-forward scoring the goals, I think because there's so many now forward-type players who score goals from elsewhere, the emphasis is not just on the centre-forward. So now, if you do play centre-forward, you don't have to be going to score 15 to 20 goals every season to get the plaudits. I think now you might score 10 goals a season but have 7 assists, and people think that's a great season, what a fantastic season he's had. Now, me being a bit of an old school striker, I wouldn't be happy with them stats. I would rather have 20 goals plus and 2 assists.
You mentioned earlier about the sort of partnerships that you had with Chef Kikuki and the way you worked with Marcus Bent in your early career and Darren Ambrose. Did you prefer playing in a 3 like that when you first started? Did you enjoy being the lone striker, or did you like playing in a partnership like you did with Shefki?
It's crazy because you're right. I go from playing under Jules Berlin and Joe Royal to playing in a kind of a 3 where it's like I play a lot of wide right, wide left. So you kind of get used to that role because you do a lot, obviously, tracking up and down the field. But back then I was fit as anything. I could run all day, back sprint all day. So playing wide, it wasn't an issue. I was still getting my fair share of goals. Then when I played in the 2 with Shefki, I said to myself, you know what? I don't want to play wide anymore. I just want to score goals, play centre forward. I love playing this role. The emphasis being on me and Big Chef to get the goals. Then when I went to Charlton from Ipswich, it was like 4-5-1. So at first, it took a bit of time. It took a bit of time and bit of getting used to where I'm thinking, well, hold on a second here. I'm having to do a lot more work here because whereas Big Shefki might do all the heavy lifting, the hustling and bustling, winning the headers, fighting off defenders, and I can feed off his kind of pieces, I was having to do a bit of everything, running behind, hold it up, fight defenders, win the headers. And at first, I wasn't sure if I was like able enough to do it. But as you go on playing more 4-5-1, and to be fair, at Charlton, I hit the ground running. I mean, I had 5 goals in my first 5 games, I think, and won the Player of the Month, Premier League Player of the Month. So that was the kind of validation I needed that, well, I can do it. And it just kind of went from there. And that was a traditional 4-5-1. It wasn't like the 4-3-3. It was 4-5-1. So 5 midfield players that kind of just sat in the middle of the park. And the wide men would get up and down, but they weren't wingers. They were just right and left midfield. So as it kind of went and progressed, I just found myself playing that role. And then I quite enjoyed playing the one up top because I could pretty much do what I pleased, run where I wanted, you know what I mean, take up positions on the pitch where I didn't have to worry about my strike partner being there. But then when you do go back to playing a 2, like on the off occasions, it's really hard to get used to because then you're running in each other's space. You know what I mean? You make the same runs. You know what I mean? Someone's always got to sacrifice really for the good of the other one. So like if there's a cross coming in the box, one of you's always got to break your neck and try and get across the near post. Like you might not score from there, but you're going to take a defender with you. And sometimes with centre forwards now, they're probably more adapting at doing that because they're, as I said, they're a bit more selfless. Like they don't mind sacrificing themselves if someone else scores. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, no one really wanted to make that run to the near post unless you could score from there.
Those runs, knowing who's going to do it, that communication between partners, or if it's you yourself, knowing whether to do it at that time or to stick, does that come instinctively? Is it something that you worked on? Is it something that you were coached?
Yeah, you kind of work on it and you coach it a little bit because you get to coach it in crossing and finishing drills. So you might put one defender in. And I was always taught, so if the ball's on the right-hand side and it's progressing down the right-hand side, if I'm the striker that's kind of near post, as the ball goes wide and it's about to come in, I would peel around the back and then Shefki, who was behind me at the back stick already, he would dart to the near post just so we could have a little bit of a crossover. So that would just maybe confuse the defenders because if I'm already at that side and I just run to the near post, it's so easy to mark. Because you're talking about, I'll have a midfield player dropping in there and I'll have the left-sided centre-half dropping in there. So effectively, I'm running out there, but not a lot changes. But the moment if I peel around to the back and Shefki darts to the front, they can't quite see Shefki coming and they can't see whereabouts I'm going around the back. So it just puts them all on edge. And they've got to worry about another midfield player getting in the box. So we was always taught, like, whatever side it was, you need to time it and cross over. You can't just run in straight lines because when you run in straight lines in any form on the pitch, it's easy to mark. Anyone can see a straight run coming in, but the moment you cross over and you start making them diagonal runs, it becomes really impossible for the defenders to mark.
Obviously, you're talking about making it more difficult for your opposition player, your defender. Did you ever have an opponent who you absolutely hated coming up against? That fixture comes out, you're like, oh no, he's on the team sheet again, I can't deal with him. Someone who got the better of you, someone who you just couldn't work out. And how did you sort of deal with that?
Yeah, easy. Leddy King.
It's Arjen Robben for Chelsea with a great chance. Oh. What a tackle. They talk about great goals. That is a great challenge. Fantastic work from Leddy King.
I played against Leddy the first time at Chelwent and we lost to them 3-2 and I scored two goals. And Leddy was not happy. I think it was him and I can't remember the other. I think it was Nabet was the centre-half. It was them two together. But he was not happy with the way he played. Like, he was absolutely fuming, Leddy. And I remember, I'll never forget, he came up to me after the game and he said to me, well played today. I went, oh, cheers, thanks. And he said to me, because I'd gone off after about 70 minutes with, like, concussion. So after, I came back out, typed it up and went to see that the boys would see it out. Because I left it, it was 2-2. I'd scored two. We were 2-0 up as well. And I remember Leddy come up to me after the game and just saying, oh, well, like, well played today, but you'll never ever do that again. And honestly, I never ever, I don't think I even had a shot against Spurs after that. Like, it was like he made it his duty to follow me absolutely everywhere. I'd make a run into the channel, he was already there. I'd go to win a header, he'd outjump me. I'd go short to try and hold the ball up, he'd nick it in front of me. It was like, honestly, he took it that personally. And I always say that he was by far, for me, the hardest defender I ever played against. He was so, so good. But I never forget that he just said, oh, you'll never ever do that again. And he backed it up.
It was like a personal vendetta against you. You'd scored two goals. He took it as an affront to his profession. And that was it for the rest of his career. Whenever he came up against
honestly,
you, he was like, you're in my pocket, pal.
He never, ever gave me a sniff after that. Honestly, it was like he took it personally. You'd think I'd abused him or did something that bad to him. He just took it that personally. And honestly, it was worse when we used to go to, like, White Hart Lane as a Charlton player, because it was awful, because he used to just follow me everywhere. Like, I'd try maybe stick off him and play on the other centre half. And he just seemed to be able to follow me everywhere. Like, I couldn't think without him getting there before me.
Still to come on Up Front with Darren Bent, he explains why he sent out that tweet whilst at Spurs.
I wasn't going to let them dictate to where I could go. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to go where I wanted to go, where I'd feel more happy.
You're listening to Up Front with Darren Bent on TalkSport.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. There's a lot more to those 90 minutes than what goes down on the pitch. With the latest odds, form guides and expert opinions, you'll know the score with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org, T's and C's apply.
He comes back out towards Ben!
The thing about being a striker is you are front and centre of everything, aren't you? You're the man that's on the poster of the club shop. You're on the side of the bus when the new kit gets launched. You're the one on the front of the programme after you've scored a hat-trick, or when there's a big game upcoming, or there's a derby match about to be played. The attention is quite sort of all-encompassing. Did you relish that attention?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it's kind of started from quite young, actually. I remember having a picture on the side of the Ipswich Town Stadium, which was absolutely massive, like promoting the new kit. It was like the, it was at the size of the stand. It was a humongous poster, and it kind of started for them. So I remember having that, had it at Cholton, obviously scoring all the goals. So I was at the kit launches, pictures everywhere, and you kind of get confidence from that, because you know you feel appreciated. It kind of stopped obviously at Spurs. Obviously didn't the my time there. Second season was better than the first one, but still it never quite evolved into what it had been. But I remember it was probably kind of Sunderland where it kind of really, really grew, because like I obviously scored the most amount of goals I'd scored in a Premier League season at Sunderland. Things were fantastic. I remember switching on the Christmas lights in Sunderland. Like it was so nice to just feel appreciated by fans. And when you score goals, these things happen. Do you know what I mean? When you're going into games, and I've always said when I played at Sunderland, scoring all the goals, the fans at times would make you feel like you're walking on water, because you could do no wrong. You know, if you scored a goal, they'd be singing your name from start to finish. They'd want your autograph. They'd want you opening the new shops. And it was honestly fantastic. And even when I went to Villa as well for the record fee, my first couple of seasons were the same again. Posters everywhere, opening shops, new kit launches and stuff. But also on the flip side of it, I remember when it started to turn, when Lambert came in at Aston Villa and it kind of quietened down, and Benteke came in and done fantastically well. And then it started to be him. I remember having conversations, just thinking like it was kind of tough to take. For so long, I was so used to being the main man, scoring all the goals, my picture everywhere, that when it starts to change, it can affect you a little bit. And it took a while for me to kind of adapt to that. Like, well, hold on a second here. I'm no longer the main man. So what do I do? And I can understand where some people might struggle with that. And to be fair, it was a difficult period, because, as I said, you'd go to like end of the season player of the year, dues, and you're used to all the fans coming up to you going, oh, can we have your autograph? Because you're the main man, you get on all the goals. But all of a sudden, when it stops and you're getting only a couple, but everyone's going to other people, listen, it's a real testing time, that is.
How did it make you feel? How did you react to it? Did you go home? Did you moan to the missus? Did it affect your game? Did you think, I've got to do more?
Do you know what?
Or did you think, I've got to get out of here, I've got to go somewhere else and start again?
No, do you know what? I think immediately when it happened, I messaged my missus straight away and said to her, like, oh, this is tough to take, this is. And she was just like, oh, just don't let it affect you. And I said, nah, I'm not going to, obviously, going to keep working hard and try and get over this hump. But it was difficult, because obviously the moment Benteke kind of took over and done fantastically well when he came to Villa, he was brilliant. It was like there was no way back in for me. Do you know what I mean? It was so difficult, because he scored a lot of goals in his first season. Then his second season, I went out on loan. I was gone the whole season. And then I came back, and it was still all about Benteke. So ultimately, really, it was all about him. And that's why Villa fans love him, and understandably so, because he was brilliant for Aston Villa. But it honestly, it's a tough one. Like, you have to have thick skin from that. You need to be able to come back from that. It's difficult. And any striker that who's been in that position where you are the main man and everything's been gone so right for so long, you talk about international recognition, you're playing for your country, and all of a sudden I got an injury, so I couldn't get back in the England squad. Then Benteke comes and takes your spot. Then it's obviously all about him. Like, it sometimes at times can be a lonely place.
You moved a few times in your career, didn't you? What considerations did you make when you were making those decisions? Did you speak to the managers and talk about how tactically they were going to use you? They were going to play you in a certain position? Did you go to certain places because you were playing with someone? Or was it because someone paid you more money to go somewhere rather than another place? What were the considerations? What was the checklist whenever you were discussing a move?
For me, Sam, mine was always about trying to get to the very, very top. And it was like, how could I get there? So obviously I moved from Ipswich to Cholton, which was Division 1, to the Premier League. So that was the first step. And then establishing myself in the Premier League, managed to do that. Then obviously the next big one was from Cholton to Spurs. So I'm thinking, right, if I can establish myself on this level, because Spurs had finished fifth twice in a row. So I thought, right, if I can establish myself on that platform, then after Spurs, then it can only be the top four. Like, from Spurs, if I can succeed there, it can only be one of the top four clubs. So obviously it didn't work out as well as I wanted it to Spurs. So then I'm looking at a scenario where I need to leave Spurs because I need to be getting more game time. I know Harry didn't really fancy me. I know he wanted Defoe there. I know he was trying to get Crouchy. I know he was trying to get others. Pavlyuchenko was still there. So even though I finished top scorer that second season, I knew I wasn't really his cup of tea. So it was then about, right, what manager is going to want me to come? What is going to want me to play for them, but wants me to play week in, week out and really believes what I can do? Well, that was Steve Bruce. And for me at the time, Sunderland was perfect for me because they needed a centre forward. They were miles away from London. I wanted to get completely away from London. I wanted to go somewhere where it was solely about football. And that's what the North East is. You know what I mean? Newcastle, Sunderland, they love their football and they love their centre forwards, really. You look about the great centre forwards that have played up there, and that came into my consideration. You look at Newcastle with Ferdinand, Shearer, Andy Cole. You look at Sunderland, Kevin Phillips, Niall Quinn. So I took all these into consideration. So I said, right, I want to go to Sunderland. And then also, you know what it's like as a player. When I'm moving to Sunderland, you check, you're looking at forums, you're looking at your Twitter, you're seeing what people are saying. And the Sunderland fans were so like, we can't wait to have him. He's going to score goals for us. It was so positive. I just couldn't wait to get there. So then, obviously, I'm there a year and a half. Obviously, top goal scorer, 2 years I was there. But all year and a half I was there. Then Villa come calling. At the time, Sunderland are, well, I think we're sixth in the table. But I already know that we're kind of overachieving. That we're winning games that we shouldn't be winning. So we beat Manchester City 1-0. But we were somehow scraping through and winning games. So I looked, Aston Villa came in for me and I looked at Aston Villa's squad and they were like fifth or sixth from bottom. But I looked at the squad they had, Stuart Downing, international, Ashley Young, international, Luke Young, international, you know, Petrov, Rio Coca, James Collin, Richard Dunn. I just said to myself, all they were missing really was a centre forward. Like Gabby Agbonlahor had been brilliant for them for a while. He wasn't scoring any goals. So I was just like, right, I had to make a decision quite well, do I go there? And Gerard Houllier as well wanted me to go there. I had a conversation with him, he wanted me to go there. So I thought if I can go there and gel with them guys, then there's no telling what could have happened. So I made the decision to go to Aston Villa. It wasn't about money or anything, it was about the players I was playing with. And that first half a season, I'd say, or second half of the season for Aston Villa was probably the best football I'd actually played personally. I know I'd scored more goals the season before for Sunderland, but as far as the way I played, was probably better playing with Ashley Young, Stuart Downing. So we ended up finishing ninth. So I thought to myself, right, this is the place I want to be. I love it here. This could be the step I needed to, you know what I mean, get to the top. Then obviously at the end of that first season I'm there, they sell Downing, Ashley Young. A lot of the best players leave. So I'm like, okay, what do we do here? Then I get injured. I get halfway through the season again, that next second season, I'm with the managers, Alex McLeish. Things are going really well. Still in the international squad, playing well. I'd had 12 Premier League goals by Christmas, so I knew things were going well. Get a big injury, missed the World Cup. I think it was the World Cup at the end of that year, and I don't play again for the rest of the season. Lambert comes in. I start the season, but we don't start well. He makes me captain. And then Benteke comes in, starts firing. I can never really get back in at Aston Villa. I go on loan to Fulham the next season. Do okay, not great, come back to Aston Villa and then end up going on loan to Brighton and Derby. So obviously they weren't going to let me go to another Premier League club, so I had to go to the Championship, which was Derby County at the time. Do really well in half a season, score 15 goals I think it was in half a season.
Derby County 1, Rotherham United 0, and just as you join us, Darren Bent has slotted the ball home for a second for Derby County.
So even then I've dropped to the Championship, but I'm thinking, right, I've got 15 goals in a short space of time. So I remember saying to myself, right, I've done well in the Championship, so people can still see I can do the fundamental, score goals, play really well. Hopefully somebody from the Premier League will come and get me, or Derby ourselves can get promoted. And for whatever reason, the last couple of years of my career, it was like I was chasing to get back to the Premier League, and whatever happened, I just couldn't get back there. I remember we played Leicester City in the Cup, FA Cup, score against Leicester, play really, really well.
It's Bent with a header and he glances it past Schmeichel, who stretches but can't reach.
I was hoping that's going to show people that I can still play in the Premier League. We play West Brom in the next season, play really well against them, score against them.
5 minutes into the second half and it's West Bromwich Albion 1, Derby County 1. And what a strike from Darren Bent. It's a solo effort. Darren Bent's the man for Derby County.
So again, I'm thinking, well, obviously people can still see that I can still play in the Premier League, I can still score goals. So hopefully someone will come and get me and give me an opportunity. But for whatever reason, Sam, it just never materialised and I never got back there.
Is that a big regret for you that you never got back?
Oh, got it.
After scoring those goals, after willing to sort of drop down to show how good you were, do you feel that Aston Villa sort of killed you in a sense?
A little bit, yeah. The whole Lambert era killed me in a such, you know what I mean? But you're right, it did kill me. I mean, listen, like, partly you're frustrated at yourself because you kind of let it happen. But as I said, when I dropped down to the Championship, I was always striving to get back to the Premier League, because that's where I felt I could really get back in and score goals. I still believe that I could have done that. But it is one of them things that you look back and think, well, how was I never given that opportunity again? And it does something that does burn me, and I think, oh, if I could have just had another crack at it, do you know what I mean? Because I feel like if I'd had another 4 or 5 years in the Premier League, there would have been more goals for me. But for whatever reason, it just didn't materialise. And as I said, that's one thing I always look back and think, oh, gutted that I'd never had the opportunity to do it again.
Do you ever look back and think to yourself, I should never have sent that tweet? The one where you say, do I want to go to Hull City? No. Do I want to go to Stoke? No. Do I want to go to Sunderland? Yes. So stop around, Levy.
I don't regret it, because they were dragging their heels, and I've kind of felt like they were trying to railroad me to go to Stoke or Hull. I think because they were, I think they at the time, they were prepared to pay the money that Daniel Levy wanted. So I kind of felt like they got Tony Pulis to ring me. They got very, I can't remember who the whole manager was at the time. It might have been Phil Brown, maybe. They got these guys to ring me to tell me how good like Stoke and Hull were. And listen, I'm sure they were great football clubs, but I only wanted to go to, I had a conversation with Steve Bruce, and he said to me, Darren, I want to ask you one question. Do you want to come to Sunderland and score goals for us and play up here? Because we want you up here. And from when I heard that, I said, yeah, definitely, I want to go up there. And that goes into, as I said, the positive feedback I'd had from the Sunderland fans before I even got there. So it was because Spurs were just mucking around and trying to railroad me into going to Stoke. So that's why I sent the tweet out. And yeah, when I think about it now, I should have done it. But do I regret doing it? No.
Did you do it because that is the type of personality you are? You're not going to take, as a striker, as a man, and I suppose these two things do sort of like tie in, you know, being that main man, that goal getter, that leading light at the front of the team. You've got the forceful personality, the confidence to be able to articulate your thoughts and feelings, and you're not going to be taken for a mug.
Yeah, of course. Like, I was never going to let someone take the mick out of me. But also as well, and this is how I've always thought, like, I knew wherever I went after Spurs, if I was given more game time, I'd score more goals. So, I think I've got 17 goals the second season for Spurs, but I didn't play that many games. So I was thinking to myself, well, if I play a full season, I know I can get a load of more goals, which is how it worked out. I ended up getting 24, 25 the second season. So I knew that was the case, but I wasn't going to let them dictate to where I could go. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to go where I wanted to go. Well, I'd feel more happy. And as I said, from the day one I got to Sunderland into the North East, I loved every minute of it.
You did score a lot of goals in that second season for Spurs, but you did miss a chance as well, didn't you? Did you really ask to leave as soon as Harry Redknapp said, once you missed against Portsmouth for Spurs, even my missus could have scored that?
No, I mean, the people have said this before. I think my agent called him just to say, like, basically, what is he playing at? I went to see him as well to say, like, well, like, why have you said that? But I never demanded that I leave. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was never that case. But even up until before that point,
did it annoy you? How did he deal with that fallout? Because that must have been It's not a great look. I mean, I know Harry, you know Harry, you know that he sometimes does just shoot off from the hip and he doesn't think about it carefully. And there are always situations with managers and players like that. But did it hurt you?
Yeah, it hurt at the time because it was, I mean, you think about it then, that it was fresh then. I mean, and how many years is it now? Maybe, what is it, 12, 13 years later? And you're still asking 11. Me about, do you know what I mean? You're still asking me about it now. So at the time it did hurt, but at the same time it was a case of, right, okay, well, I'm going to have to show him. And I managed to score, obviously. I think I scored two the weekend afterwards. But it's just, you're right, it's Harry. And I mean, we've spoke about it, we've laughed about it. Obviously, when I've seen him after that event, do you know what I mean? But at the time, it was just a case of, like, I don't know why I said that, but that all rolls into the feeling of, as I said, I know he didn't really fancy me as a player, and he wanted to get, I think the phone might have been there already, but I know he wanted to get Crouchy, he wanted to get other options in there, and I fully understood that, so I can kind of, like, grasp that he was always going to say something like that, but not even something like that, but I just knew that he didn't really fancy me and didn't really want me there, so it was only a matter of time before I left that football club anyway.
Rooney. Oh, slides a lovely pass here to Ashley Young, and Darren Bent can't miss from there.
Walker looking to get past Paulson. Theo Walcott able to play it across. It's the equaliser. Darren Bent, what a start to this friendly.
Let's talk then more in detail about England, because it must have been an amazing experience, right, putting that England shirt on for the first time.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I loved it. Every minute of it. I mean, but unfortunately, you think to yourself, I should have had more caps. And I do believe that with the amount of goals I scored, I should have had more caps. But it's still the most special feeling in the world. And I always say to young players now, because I know at a time when you get in the international squad, that it was long. It was like 10 days. It was long. There's not a lot to do and you get a bit bored. And that used to maybe send players who didn't want to go there because they had enough. They didn't want to be away from home for 10 days. But to be fair, I will say to young players now, if you get the opportunity to play for your country, do it. Because it is honestly, when you no longer have it, you miss it like crazy. And I was the same. When I could no longer get back into that England squad, it really hurt. Because I cherish every moment of it and wish I could have cherished it even more.
Yeah, because you had that experience where you didn't get into the World Cup squad in 2010. And then just after that, sort of what was a terrible World Cup for England, you were back in the team against Switzerland, 7th of September 2010. You score your first goal. Have you got a tattoo of that or something? Or have you got a memorabilia for that? Because that must have been, you know, almost like a redemption moment, being left out by Capello in 2010 to go to South Africa, but then coming straight back and getting on the score sheet almost immediately.
Remember, it happened to me before that, because it happened to me in 2005 as well, where I missed out on that one. I scored, I think it was the highest scoring Englishman, 22 goals. And I didn't go to that World Cup. Mm. So when it happened the second time under Capello, I knew how to deal with it because I kind of knew it was coming. I don't know why, I just felt it. But to be fair to Fabio, after that World Cup, as you said there, he said to me, "Oh, listen, Darren, like, I made a mistake. I should have taken you. But listen, from now on, you're going to be my centre forward. So just keep playing well for your club, keep scoring goals. And you know what I mean? You are my centre forward." And he never went back on that. Like, as you said, I scored the goal, my first goal. And then he started me all the other games after that until I got injured against Wigan and obviously missed the rest of the season. But he realised that he should have taken me. And it was just refreshing to hear an England manager say that he's made a mistake.
That sort of must also stick in your craw, because then you've got the run. You're the striker. You're the man in possession of the shirt. It's 2010-11. You're the top scorer in English football from an English point of view. You're cruising towards the Euros in 2012. Capello leaves, but you've already got injured against Wigan. You must have thought you were a dead cert for 2012, but obviously because of the injury and subsequent injuries, you couldn't get into Roy Hodgson's plans.
Yeah, it was a killer, because I think I scored in the last game as well when we qualified, which was against 2-2 against, is it Montenegro, was it?
Ashley Young and Darren Bent can't miss from there.
I remember I scored in that game as well. So obviously, I knew full well that if I'd stayed fit the rest of that season, as I said, even my club form for Villa, like I had 12 goals already before Christmas, so I knew I was in good form. As well as, I think I'd had 3-3 in the international stage as well, so I knew I was a cert to go this time. But then when the injury comes, you just start thinking to yourself, well, maybe it just wasn't written in the stars for me. And that's why I always think to myself, like, there's no point me thinking about what would have been, but unfortunately it just wasn't in my stars. And yeah, it's gutting, but not really a lot I could have done.
You're a really positive person, aren't you? Because, you've achieved so much. You're a Football League Cup winner. You've played multiple games in the Premier League. You're a part of the 100 clubs. You've got more goals in the Premier League than Didier Drogba. But you look back sort of in a sort of almost wistful way, but you're still quite sort of satisfied, are you, with your career? You're happy with it? Because, I suppose you should be.
Yeah, you are, but you always feel you can achieve more. Like, and I know even some of the players who've won absolutely everything and played at the highest level for a long time will feel they could achieve more. But I always think to myself that the opportunity just wasn't there for me. Like, and I look back to certain scenarios. I might have gone to a World Cup with England, done really well, and who knows what could have happened after that. But again, it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't written for me. But I still look back. I've still got a lot of memorabilia in shirts and pictures and things like that. And obviously, when my kids look at the wall there, do you know what I mean? They're extremely proud of Daddy. But at the same time, as players, you always feel like you could achieve more. And I certainly feel like I could have done the same.
Now, at the end of these interviews, we've been testing our number nines. We've called it the perfect hat trick. And now, you failed miserably on Celebrity Mastermind with your specialist subject,
cheers,
James Bond. Right? That's all right, no problem. But so if we change the subject to Special Agent Bent, do you think you'll be able to answer three questions about yourself?
I'd like to think so, yeah.
Yeah, but you'd like to think that you'd be able to go on Celebrity Mastermind and answer more than one correct answer about your specialist subject. So, you know, we're, I'm not 100% confident myself, to be honest with you.
Neither am I, honestly. But listen, we've got to give it a go.
I'm not as intimidating as John Humphreys. It's okay. In November 2001, good month for you, by the way, you made your first team debut for Ipswich Town. Against which opponent and what was the score?
My Premier League debut?
No. First team debut.
All right, I'm going to say it was against Helsingborg in the UEFA Cup.
Do you know the score?
And I think we won 2-0 or 1-0.
3-1. Oh. Close. I'm going to give you it. Because, I mean, to remember Helsingborg is great. So you get half a point for that.
Thank you.
With 25 goals in 40 games in all competition, 24 of them in the Premier League, by the way, what season was your best scoring season and for whom?
Well, it was for Sunderland. Did you say what year did you say?
I said what season, yeah.
2009-2010.
Correct. Ooh. How did you not go to the World Cup after that? That's unbelievable.
Exactly, what I'm asking.
This one might give me a bit of an indication and the audience about your character, right? Because everyone remembers their first goal for their country. Mm-hmm. Everyone remembers their first goal full stop. But what about your second goal? This is your last question, right? So this is a chance to get 2.5 out of 3. This would be pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. Your second goal was a simple tap-in at the far post against Denmark in the Parken Stadium.
Yep.
The year was 2011. It was February. It was cold. Who provided the assist?
Theo Walcott,
able to play it across. It's the equaliser. Darren Bent.
Oh, he smashed it. Yeah. Smashed it out of the park. That was fantastic. They didn't even take a beat there. You knew. Can you still remember the goal? Is that what it is? You can remember every single one of those international goals.
I can remember that one. I can remember the one against Wales. That's the one I probably like the most because it was just quite hostile. Full house at Millennium Stadium. I mean, I always think about that one. I've got that pictures in my gym at home, that big blood picture when I scored and celebrated. I can remember that one.
Brilliant. Listen, thank you very much for your time.
No,
it's been superb to get an insight into your career. I've loved it, and I'm sure the audience have as well. And it's been a privilege to look back on such an illustrious career. Keep wearing the banging clothes. And next time you go on a quiz show, make sure you do a little bit more research.
I'll do that. I'll make sure I do that for you.
You've been listening to Upfront with Darren Bent and me, Sam Matterface. And if you missed any of the show or just want to catch up on previous episodes, then you can listen on the TalkSport app via the Game Day podcast feed.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.